Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today, Sagar and I are speaking with geopolitical strategist Peter Zeihan about his new book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning, which was just released. Conversation is about Peter's central contention in the book that we're going to look back at the year 2019 as the last great year for the global economy. Basically, he argues that the era of globalization from the late 20th century to the basic year 2019, as he puts it very exactly, was an artificial state where you could have all sorts of goods shipped. There was broad global peace. The U.S. subsidized the global commons through spending money on the Navy to keep sea lanes open. He argues that all of those factors are basically coming to a close, which is going to build into a world which is going to look quite more chaotic and actually symbolize a real realignment of the geopolitical and geoeconomic systems. The book is basically about exploring how this is going to affect China, the United States, Europe, global energy prices, and just the basic life and economic experiences that we've grown used to that we may have to leave behind. So once again, Peter is one of the most requested guests we've ever had on The Realignment. So if you're excited to offer him up to you all. Before we get into this, though, I want to shout out that if you liked this episode and want to support the show, you could subscribe to our Supercast at realignment.supercast.com. Or you click the link at the top of our show notes. We've actually just started publishing exclusive subscriber content. So yesterday I released an exclusive interview that will feature Peter Bergen, who was a previous guest on the show, to talk about the Trump administration and how it's going to set how it approaches the 2024 election. And tomorrow, Sagar and I are going to publish our first ever Ask Me Anything episode with subscriber questions submitted through our Supercast page. Once again, all this is available at realignment.supercast.com. Two, Peter's written a bunch of really great books. So if you'd like to support him, support independent booksellers, and give our show a nice 10% commission, you could follow the link in our show notes to the bookshop page we've put together, which features all of his books and is once again a great way to support everyone listed above. For all that, huge thank you to our sponsor, Lincoln Network. Let's get into the episode. Peter Zeihan, welcome to The Realignment.
It's great to be here.
It's good to see you, Peter.
So your latest book is about two big themes, end of globalization and demographic collapse. We'll get into those two very big topics a little later in the show, but I just wanted to start Yeah, you know, you finally got it. And I want to start with the most provocative central idea here, which is basically this thought that 2019 was the best year that a lot of us are going to experience this century, which feels really counterintuitive to basically everyone, especially the past 3 years. So I'd love for you to articulate that.
Sure. We got two things going on at the same time. The first is that the Americans have lost interest in supporting the global system, so it's spinning apart. Even if we wanted to continue to play the role that we've played since 1946, our Navy has changed. We've got 12 supercarriers now and very few destroyers. We can't patrol the global oceans to protect commerce, which means that we have to choose who is safe and who is not, and we have a list. Most countries are not on it. Second, when the Americans created the globalized system back in the 40s, it allowed everyone to move off the farm and into towns and take manufacturing and services jobs. Well, when you move into town, you have fewer kids because instead of being free labor on the farm, they're now just really, really expensive pieces of furniture. And so you have fewer of them because adults aren't dumb. You fast forward that 70 years, and we've got 70 years of demographic destruction that is now all coming to a head. Most countries, especially in the advanced world, but also several in the advanced developing world, have now aged past the point of possible theoretical repopulation. So it's not just that we're running out of consumers and producers, it's we're running out of capital producers. And very soon, this moment of wealth that we've been living in since roughly 2000 is going to pass because those people who provided the consumption and the wealth are now moving into mass retirement. We've never experienced something like this in global history before, and it's going to be a rocky road.
Yeah.
I actually want to follow up on the Navy point real quick, just to better understand where you're coming from. So to your point, like 12 aircraft carriers, destroyers. But if you're thinking of a lot of the ways that the US has played a naval role the past, let's say, two decades, it's interdicting pirates and, you know, around Somalia. That doesn't really have anything to do with an aircraft carrier. That doesn't actually necessitate a destroyer. That's a combination of special forces and other different bits there. So can you talk more about what you're specifically getting at with like the specific types of naval surface ships we're putting out there?
You have to understand why we've done what we've done. So the United States created the global system in order to bribe up an alliance to fight the Cold War. And in that, it worked. And we provided global naval patrol so that anyone could ship anything and work with any partner at any time and access any market. So for the first time in human history, your cargo ships didn't necessarily need a military escort. And that meant that we went from having a few dozen of them to a few tens of thousands of them over the course of the next 70 years. But since the Cold War ended, the United States has steadily changed its naval disposition. So we're in the process right now of floating the new Ford class. They're the most powerful vessels ever it's the most powerful military platform used by any country in any era. We're going to have four of them. One by itself has the aircraft capacity of the seventh most powerful air force in the world. And that's assuming it's a fair fight, which it never would be because aircraft carriers can move. Mm-hmm. So really, you're only talking about three countries in the world that might be able to fend off one of these. We've got four Fords and 10 Nimitzes. That's a lot. I mean, if you want to knock off a country, this is how you do it. But if you want to patrol the global oceans, you need many, many, many more points of contact. 14 carriers isn't going to cut it. So you need hundreds of destroyers, almost 1,000 probably these days with the volume of traffic we have. We have 70. So there's no theoretical possibility for the United States or any other country to take that role up. People like to talk about the Chinese having more ships than we do. Yes, but 90% of them are small, and 90% of them can't sail more than 1,000 miles from the coast. So they're useless in trade management.
Right. So, Peter, I think that's one thing I want to stick to, which is what does the demise of the de facto blue water Navy, the ability of U.S. power projection, which, yes, you can knock off a country, but not necessarily being able to protect the global sea lanes. What does that level of chaos mean? Especially given that the Chinese Navy is not able to project power beyond about 1,000 miles away from its own borders. In that vacuum, what do you think is going to emerge?
Well, in the shorter term, we're probably going to have a series of military conflicts, much like the Ukraine war, when local regional powers, whether out of desperation or opportunity, decide to carve out their own new sphere of influence, with the Americans largely gone. The Russians are starting in Ukraine. That is hardly the end of the story. There's about a dozen countries that they're going to be going after, assuming they are not defeated in Ukraine. In the case of the Chinese system, it means a collapse of the manufacturing model. You know, even if Xi didn't have an incredibly destructive force of personality that was destroying manufacturing in the country in real time, and even if the COVID vaccine in China worked, and even if China had a demographic structure that could survive the decade. You know, all of these are kind of non-negotiable at this point, but let's assume for the moment that these are not problems. China is completely dependent upon global commerce for raw materials, especially energy and food, and then for merchandise exports to the wider world. And they're completely incapable of securing those routes themselves. So best case scenario for China is probably an 80% reduction in their standard of living and probably reduction of their population by half. They're the country that is going to suffer most from the deglobalized system. And I'd argue that we're getting very close to that cliff edge right now. It was just a couple of weeks ago that the Greeks and the Iranians were confiscating each other's ships.
Yep.
And, you know, the Greeks do not play that game. So to have a minor power that registers a lot of vessels now starting to get in on trade, enforcement isn't the right word. Let's call it non-integration. Gives you an idea of how far this has gone. If you're looking for the kind of the next step, the Europeans are no longer allowing their insurance firms to insure cargoes of Russian oil.
Right.
That's 95% of the insurance market that is no longer applied. So it is going to be up to individual sovereign nations to provide sovereign indemnification, which, if you want to talk about something that would crash the Russian system and establish exactly what a sanction really means, can you imagine now one of the Western nations grabbing one of those ships when another country has offered the insurance policy. So they have to suck up the entire loss. I mean, you're talking multi-billions. This is going to get really interesting really fast.
That's fascinating. I want to follow on that Russia point that you made there. I mean, what do you foresee? You said Russia is just beginning, assuming they're not defeated in Ukraine, assuming that they can have basically a mid-grade war in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine. What do you think is next?
It's not just the Donbass. Mm-hmm. The Russians are hoping to reestablish a more defensive perimeter. Most Russian territory is open, it's flat, and it's middling farmland. So you have a relatively light, well, actually not relative, you have a very light population density through even the populated parts of the country. And whenever a foe gets into the Russian heartlands, it becomes a war of movement. And since the foe had to move to get there, they tend to outperform Russian forces, which are very static and slow.
Right.
And so Russia has been invaded 50-odd times throughout its history. What the Russians are trying to do is preempt the next invasion because their demographic is in freefall, and they know that if they don't do it now, they're going to not have a chance later. So they want to forward position forces in the access points that give that are gateways to the Russian territories. Two of those gateways are on the other side of Ukraine. So it's not just that Russia is not going to stop until it gets all of Ukraine. Russia is not going to stop when it gets all of Ukraine, mm-hmm. which is one of the reasons why the NATO countries are so desperate to stop it here, because there's five NATO countries on the next list.
You know, something I'm curious about, Sagar and I have had this debate. This is something that a lot of geopolitical analysts are debating right now, this idea of should the U.S. focus on Europe, basically where our allies are, our traditional relationships, or Asia, the future, GDP growth, all of those bits. But you just gave a very pessimistic articulation of Asia's prospects, especially centered on China for the rest of the century, and combining your point about like 80%, you know, collapse is like the best case scenario. Could you talk about this whole like future is Asia idea, given what you just articulated and given the fact that in the world you're describing, certain regions are going to do better than others?
Well, let me start by saying that Americans aren't happy unless we're stressing about something. So, you know, when the Soviet Union fell, we found a new boogeyman. That's just how we are. It's one of our endearing quirks, in my opinion, because it means that we're always running a little bit faster than we would otherwise need to be, and that keeps us on our toes. But the story of China, the story of Korea, the story of Japan, the story of Singapore, the story of most of East Asia is globalization. When globalization allowed countries to move off the farm and into the cities, in Asia, it happened in mass. And in Asia, the density of the population pre-industrialization was the highest in the world. So in the industrialized era, we just got these mega cities that are absolutely dependent upon supply chains that stretch around the world. But that also means their demographic collapse is the fastest in the world. So Korea and China are by far the two that are furthest along. And the only way a country that has more people in their 60s and 50s and 40s than their 30s, 20s, and 10s is by exporting. So they absolutely have to remain integrated. And if something happens to that integration, they don't have an economic model. The problem that we're seeing in Japan and Korea, and to a far lesser degree, Taiwan right now, is it's not just that they have more people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, it's that the bulk of them are now on the very verge of retirement. And so they're not going to be able to maintain the productive system either. This all breaks this decade. That's when all of these countries age into mass obsolescence. So we have already seen in China the fastest increases in wages over the last 22 years of any country in any era in all of history. There is no longer a manufacturing subsector in China that can't be done cheaper in North America. The only reason we still think of China as a manufacturing hub is because of the sunk cost of the industrial plant, and that's not insignificant. We can't replace that overnight. But every time something relocates from China, it has a better supply chain that's shorter, that's cheaper, that's closer to the end consumer and higher quality. So there's nothing left for the Chinese to excel at, and they're facing the demographic bomb at the same time.
Peter, what do you make of the...
Quick follow-up on that. You made your boogeyman reference at the start of that last answer, which is an important point, because like to people who aren't read into the 1980s, like Sagar and I weren't alive then, in the 1980s, as the Cold War was no offense, that was not meant as a dunk.
Sorry.
As the, you know, you were born in 1981, it's okay. You know, as the Cold War was coming to an end, you saw people starting to say like, okay, our next big great power rival is going to be Japan. So like there's this like longstanding history of the United States basically, I don't want to say overly concerned, but being concerned about the next great rival. You seem to be implying that China is basically the equivalent of Japan. In terms of like the US being precarious, they're taking our industrial base, but it turned out the 1990s happened and who's talking about Japan as our great rival anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
So could you expand on this boogeyman idea then?
Absolutely. It's a very familiar story in the United States that if we don't have somebody that we're stressed about, we start stressing about each other. And we all have seen in recent years how much fun that is. But it's part of our geography. When the United States was settled, for the first 150 years, it was just expanding into some of the best farmland in the world with some of the best, with the best navigable waterways in the world. So everything was just easier and it got better every year for 150 years. We don't have a cultural framework built into our identity of threats. We expect everything to get noticeably better constantly. And so when it doesn't, we kind of lose our shit. 9/11 is a great example. Obviously, it was a tragedy, 3,000 dead. But as a side effect of our military interventions in the Middle East, we put the sharp end of American power on either side of every major trade and energy artery on the planet. Sputnik, of course, is the classic one. I mean, it was a beeping aluminum grapefruit, but we ripped up our entire educational and scientific system and coasted on the benefits of that revolution for 60 years. We tend to overreact, but it also means we overreact in our fixing of what we perceive the problem to be. And that tends to define global affairs for decades at a time.
So if China then, what is your... Sum up what our current approach to China is, and what would your analytical ideal reaction be?
We've got three things that are going on that honestly were bipartisan, both Trump and Biden. And I know that's like, don't say that too loud. But they, in terms of foreign policy and especially foreign economic policy, they are almost identical. Number one, we will never end the tariff system that we have against the Chinese. That is populist more than it is nationalist. More than it is economic, but it still has the same effect. So China is no longer a trusted partner. Number two, the United States is changing its military disposition. And it's not so much that we're moving forces to Asia, it's that we're moving forces away from the position where they could actually support Chinese trade. Now, I've always been of the feeling that when your country bases its existence on the Americans' willingness to bleed and die to protect your ability to get energy and food and challenge the Americans, that you have a problem with your national thinking. But we're seeing that all break apart right now, and the Russian war is the first phase of that. Third, there's a concern that China's not going to last long enough to be a full boogeyman. The demographic collapse there is so far advanced, and the Chinese are starting to release bits and pieces of their 2020 census, which suggests that they've overcounted their population by in excess of 100 million people, all of whom would have been born after 1980, and most of whom would have been women, which suggests that the Chinese population will shrink by half by just 2050. And if that proves true, you know, China doesn't survive this decade. We'll have to find somebody else to freak about.
Peter, what do you make then of a Hal Brand's argument in, I think it was in Foreign Policy or maybe The Atlantic, which is that if we accept this analysis and we know that China has peaked and Xi can read a table, demographic table with the, you know, the actual data that they have, which is probably even worse than what they put out, then isn't now, like today, the most logical time in order to take Taiwan and in order to fulfill the maximalist agenda of the CCP?
I can see the logic of that, because if it's a purely nationalist question, having something to rally around certainly would help the CCP survive what is going to be a traumatic deindustrialization process. I mean, you can't lose half the population of your country and not have a political challenge. I mean, that'd be kind of silly. And so before the Ukraine war, I was thinking kind of a 1 in 3 chance that this was going to happen. I've reevaluated that. The Ukraine war has been kind of a testing ground for Chinese theories on how the world works. And the Chinese have always looked to the Russians as an example, not necessarily to follow, but something to learn from. So when the Soviet system collapsed, they're like, okay, we are not going to lose with a duo. But some sort of perestroika, we're going to keep the lockdown. And because of that, China still exists today. But the assumptions that China has made have all been proven false. So the idea was that the war would be quick. And in Ukraine, that's clearly not going to be the case. And Taiwan's been preparing for their war with the Chinese for 10 times as long as the Russians have been preparing for their war with the Ukrainians, not to mention that Taiwan has a moat. So the idea that this would be a quick and easy fight, that's gone away. The idea that no one would intervene militarily has been proven hilariously wrong. The idea that the world would just suck it up because Russia is an important country and everyone needs food and energy, that's been proven false. Mm-hmm. And if you take the sanctions that have been put against the Russians and you put them against the Chinese, oh, dear God, you would crash the system in less than a year. You would have famine in 6 months. The trains would stop running in three. It would be a catastrophe. But I think what has really terrified Xi the most is the boycotts. The idea that like individual people can have an influence on large-scale corporate policy, that is so foreign to the CCP's experience. They don't even know how to process that. So every assumption they've made has been proven wrong in the first month of the war. And normally, this would be the part where you take your smart people and you put them in the back room with some pizza and some beer and have them come up with a plan B. But Xi's cult of personality is now so all-encompassing that he's killed all the smart people. So there's no one left. It's just Xi. It's just the ideology. It's just the propaganda. And China is slamming its head into the wall over and over and over until something cracks. And we're seeing cracks throughout the entire system today. Their mismanagement of COVID is just one example.
You know, what's interesting about what you're saying, though, because I like your point of China, I don't like in terms of the results, but like the analysis of the 2020s being a really perilous decade for China, that they're fat for reducing the chance that they're going to be that boogeyman. But it seems if you look at history, right, if you look at, let's say, Nazi Germany in 1941 deciding to invade Russia, terrible decision. But if you're Hitler, you're thinking we need the Lebensraum. We have all these problems. We're going to be cut off from our markets. This, and that. Look at the, you know, Germans in the, you know, with Great Britain in 1914. It seems that when these great powers feel the most boxed in, that's when they actually become the most dangerous. So I'm kind of like wondering if like I could agree with you long term, but it seems like the things that make you correct long term actually increase the danger this decade. So what do you think about that dynamic?
I'd argue it's a 50-50 split, and I think you're thinking the right way. Cornered powers tend to lash out if they can. Declining powers who are incapable of reaching what they need with military means tend to just die. So the Soviet collapse is probably the best example of the peaceful approach. And I broadly think that some version of that is going to happen to China. I mean, you never know. China's history is replete with how it can all go to hell in a short period of time. Not all of it's pretty. None of it's pretty. But there's nowhere for them to go. There's no place that they can go and invade that solves their problems. Even if they captured Taiwan, it's not like they would be part of the global trading system anymore because they couldn't operate the semiconductor fabs themselves. If they could, they'd already have them. The United States and Japan does the designs for them. So Taiwan is a good nationalist chest-beating topic, but it actually doesn't achieve anything strategically anymore. They could go into Vietnam again, and when they went in 79, they got treated to the same gentle welcome that Americans did. But that doesn't solve any problems either. They can't get to India because of the Himalayas. They can't go to Russia because the Russians will nuke them. That just leaves Kazakhstan, which leaves me wondering what the winner gets. There's no war scenario here that helps China from a trade and energy, a food, or a manufacturing point of view.
And a quick follow-up, because I'm really curious about this. We keep using the term China, which brings to mind the nation state. But as you know, and I think listeners know, there's China, the nation state, and then there's the Chinese Communist Party. So when you say specifically that this could mark the end of China, do you mean that it marks the end of China, this like 5,000-year-old like civilizational nation state? Yes. Or do you mean that it's the end of the Chinese Communist Party?
This is the end of China. This is the end of the Han ethnicity. Now, that's not going to disintegrate completely in 10 years, but definitely this century. The population bust is so extreme and so far advanced, there is no way that the Han survive as an entity, much less remotely in their current borders by the end of the century.
Quick push to get a little woke for a second. Racial identity is a social construction. So like if you think of what the Han project is and like, you know, Uyghurs in Western China, they're trying to make them more Han. So can you like talk about like, what is a Han? If I'm going to be a CCP,
The CCP is now stationing agents in homes of Uyghurs so that the wife and the husband don't have intercourse.
Right.
It is a flat out genocide. There is no issue of re-education here.
No, I think that's important. I think, you know, actually following up on this, then if we return to Chinese history, what do we think it's most akin like? The warlord period of the 1910s, the post-Mongol period of the Song Dynasty, King Dynasty, whatever. There's like five different dynasties.
I
don't even know all of them. But six different dynasties that are all weirdly coexisting with occasional Central Asian rulers. Like, what does it look like for the territory, for the nation state?
We've never seen this kind of population collapse. You know, the Black Death, when it hit Europe, wiped out a third of the population and took everybody 150 years to recover. Now, that set the stage for some positive things like the Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution, but in the meantime, it kind of sucked.
Yeah.
What we're seeing here is a population decline, not as quick as what happened with the Black Death, but far more holistic and without an obvious recovery. One of the things that we're dealing with in China and a lot of countries around the world is you can only have a large population structure with industrialized inputs, whether it's food or medicine or infrastructure. You take that away, and that is what is going away, and you have to revert to pre-industrial population patterns. Now, in any country, this is going to be a horrific challenge, but in China specifically, they industrialized so fast, within 45, 50 years. So we have seen a complete scrubbing of the skill sets that are necessary to engage in large-scale pre-industrial agriculture. It's just not part of the skill set anymore. So if you then remove the industrial inputs, you're talking about population crashes from famine and decivilization at the same time. What emerges on the backside of that is an open question. Now, historically speaking, I think the most likely outcome here a decade from now is that the North will descend into kind of a neo-Maoist tyranny that makes the Cultural Revolution look like a picnic, where the population collapses are by far the most extreme. And the return from the emptying of the cities to the countrysides as people return to subsistence agriculture is the norm. So a completely pre-industrialized tyrannic society. And then separately, you will have the city-states from Shanghai down to Guangzhou. Historically, these cities have gotten the majority of their food from abroad. They partner with foreign companies and countries to get food and to get capital and to get technology, and then they process that with local labor and infrastructure to make products to participate in someone else's supply chain. And that has been the norm for those city-states for most of recorded history.
You know, I want to bring up one last thing on China before we move on. What I wonder about, though, is the role of technology, automation, like those very obvious cliches, but also like the very just true dynamics. I follow a couple like CCP show accounts, and something they've like pointed out in past weeks, like responding to this demographic question, is folks who say this is going to be devastating for our industry are ignoring the fact that right now already the Chinese system is far more automated than it was. So it requires less like workers. So a world where they continue to grow, you know, growth is down, but growth continues. You have increased automation, therefore requiring fewer workers in more concentrated spaces. why isn't technology going to be the deus ex machina for them, basically? Well,
the productivity stats that we're able to get out of China, and yes, I know Chinese statistics, don't support that argument. They suggest that while total labor productivity has increased by a factor of 2 or 3 since 2000, total labor cost has increased by a factor of 22. So it's just not happening. Now, the automation is required. The automation that is required to make this, to really move the needle, is expensive, and it doesn't come from very many places. The machinery that the Chinese make is very low end. So if you want to do textiles, you know, it's probably okay for that, but you're not going to use it for automotive. For that, they have to import either from the United States or from the Europeans, with the Germans generally being kind of the go-to country for everyone. They do the best machinery in the world. And then there's the problem that you still have to train the folks. And if they haven't moved up the value added scale fast enough, then you have another problem. So I can see the Chinese being squeezed from both sides. There's also a third issue that is more relevant for most of the rest of the world as opposed to the Chinese. Machinery is expensive. Installing it is expensive. Building it is expensive. Retooling it constantly as the product evolves is expensive. And since we have this baby boomer cadre globally that is on the in the process of retiring right now, they're taking their investment capital with them. So anything you want to do that's new, especially installing new industrial plant, now has to be done in an environment of tighter capital markets than we have seen since at least the 70s, probably longer.
Peter, I want to talk about America. I realize we're talking about Russia, we're talking about China. Turn some of your analysis inward. The last time you and I talked on Breaking Points, you talked about America and populism. What's going to happen to our population? What are the meta trends here that are going to inform global trends as well?
Well, let's start with the good news. The United States is the world's largest energy and agricultural producer and the world's largest energy and agricultural exporter. That's a good start. Also, our baby boomers did something that no one else's did, and they had kids. So say what you will about the millennials, they're here. And that provides the United States with ballast in its consumption and its production now, and will provide ballast with its advanced production, its tech system, and its capital generation in 10 years. That's great. I mean, that you know, you can't screw that up. We'll try, but I don't think we're going to make it. The biggest challenge the United States is going to have for the next 5 years is rebuilding that industrial plant, hopefully before the Chinese system completely implodes. I doubt we're going to make it. So we're going to have a simultaneous shock from product shortages. At the same time, we're trying to build that dirty word, inventory, to insulate us. At the same time, we're trying to build out everything about our manufacturing system. This is going to generate what will probably be the most inflationary period, at least since World War II. And it will last for at least 5 years. Now, while we could theoretically screw this up, this is probably also going to be the fastest growth that America has experienced since before the Civil War, because we're looking at just a massive expenditure to build out that asset class that's necessary for us to have the things that we want and need. We're doing this with the baby boomers retiring. We're doing this with Gen Z, the young kids coming in, and the boomers were the largest generation we've ever had. Gen Z is our smallest one ever. So we already have a shortage of 400,000 workers a year in a time that we need to double the industrial plant. This is going to be rough. But on the backside of this, we'll have a more stable supply chain system that is largely within North America and is subject to North America things. That's not going to trigger a global trend. That's going to remove the United States from really caring at all about how foreign supply chains work. And that's going to leave us to other countries to either pick up the pieces or shrivel.
So this is something I want to drill into a little bit, because I've been kind of obsessed with this. I have realized in recent times, with inflation and the supply shocks in particular, I'm like, oh, this is not going away for years. I mean, no matter what, we are not letting Russia back into the community of nations. I think that's no matter what you think of that policy, which means gas is going to be $3.50 and higher a gallon for probably the next decade.
There's a lot of things that can be done on that.
I'm curious, though, because we need refinery capacity. You know, the Jones Act isn't getting repealed anytime soon. We have all kinds of insanity baked into our bureaucratic systems here that I see no faith that will. I'm curious. I'd love to hear your response.
overall, I think you're on point. We're going to have shortages in a number of products because of what the Russians are, well, because the Russian stuff is being removed from the system.
Right.
Former Soviet commodities being dumped on the global market since 1992 are one of the two biggest reasons why inflation has been so low for the last 30 years. And that's completely going away. So the oil situation is obviously huge. Natural gas for the Europeans and for fertilizer markets is huge. Fertilizer markets in general is a nightmare. We're losing 70% of the world's neon. That means we get to decide later this year what doesn't get a semiconductor because we can't make as many. On the gasoline question specifically, however, the U.S. president has the authority from the 2015 budget bill to summarily bar oil exports. So what's going on with our oil markets right now is we export several million barrels a day of high-quality shale crude that's light and sweet and broadly easy to refine, and we import a similar amount of heavy sludge, primarily from Canada, but not exclusively, that we only, the United States has the refineries that are sophisticated enough to turn into high-end product. And then we export some of that product as well. If Biden were to reinstitute the oil ban, all the shale crude would be locked up in the United States. You'd have catastrophic energy prices globally, but you'd have rock bottom energy prices within the United States.
Right.
And we would have to go through a blitz of refining capacity expansion. Because while Biden can bar exports of crude, he can't bar exports of any other energy product, including gasoline and diesel. So I can see an environment where the refiners bitch and moan and scream for a couple of years until they've built out like 4 or 5 million barrels a day of new capacity. And then all of a sudden, they're like the fattest cats in the land because they have imported crude, they have local crude, they have different blends they can turn into different products, and every single one of them is exportable to an energy market globally that is sky high. That is how you make $1 billion these years.
Listen, Peter, if I've actually been saying this. I'm like, if I had access to capital, I'd build two things. I'd build an oil refinery and I'd build a nuclear reactor. Now, the problem is that the regulatory and ideological environment against both of those things nearly make it impossible. And I completely agree with you on the export. Well,
refining is not as hard as you think.
Well, yes, we haven't built one since 1977, right?
Right. But we have doubled the capacity of the ones we have. Every refinery, by definition, has a lot of standoff space because when you work with petrochemicals, you don't want to be close to a housing unit.
Right.
So we have seen, especially in Texas, significant buildouts. And I can see new fractionating and distillation units being built at every single facility that can tap the shale market. That is largely Texas. And let me add something to your investment target, a fertilizer plant.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Because we're looking at least a 3-year shortage of everything.
Yeah. Well, let's go into some of the other shortages. Since you have such deep knowledge on this, I think I try to spell it out for people, gas, food, because these are the basics of the American bedrock. But, it skyrockets everything. Like you said, neon, you can't make semiconductors. That means you can't buy a new car. That means you can't buy, several types.
Well, you can buy an analog car.
That's right. but no one's getting the 2023 Tesla anytime soon. It's going to be my prediction. So where else do you see some of the big shortages that can have macro political shifts?
Oh God, there's so many. Let's start with cell phones. The two ecosystems for cell phones are either Korea-based or China-based with Apple. So Korea-based with Android, China-based with Apple. Apple has put 90% of its sourcing in the PRC. And every time that something has happened that has made them, maybe think twice about that, they've decided to double down. So they are the most exposed company in the world to the China collapse. So if you don't get the next iPhone, you're probably not going to have an iPhone for several years. Korea is a little bit better, but they have a system that is sourced throughout the East Asian Rim. They are also China dependent, not to the same degree. But Korea is one of those fast aging countries, arguably one of the top three fastest aging in the world. It's unclear how long they can maintain that system without the Americans helping. And it's not clear that the Americans want to. Steel's an issue. The Russians are the world's largest exporter of pig iron. Russia plus Ukraine are the largest. Some countries, most countries, your Indias, your Chinas, your Frances, your Germanys, they do all of it in their own country. So they import the iron ore, they turn it into an intermediate product in a blast furnace, then they finally refine it into more advanced products. It's all there. They see it as a national security issue. The United States is the world's best steel recycler. So almost 99% of the steel that we use goes through a second, third, fourth, fifth, and 17th use. But whenever we need something to be pretty, like cladding on an appliance or a roof work or anything you see on the outside of a building, anything that's visible, you need virgin steel for that generally. And so we don't smelt iron ore hardly at all. We buy pig iron off the international market and then use it to make the pretty stuff. 2/3 of our supply comes from Russia and Ukraine. So that's one where the rest of the world is, I don't want to say okay, but they can deal. Whereas we're probably going to have a problem. We're going to have some ugly buildings. And there's no way around that until you build a new steel facility, which we haven't done in quite some time. There's an argument that a lot of this is coming back. If it is, it will. But again, you don't build that industrial plant overnight. The one I'm most concerned about is fertilizer. Belarus plus Ukraine plus Russia is 40% of global phosphate. It takes 10 years to bring a phosphate mine online. The natural gas prices in Europe have gotten so high, they're not even making nitrogen fertilizer. We're expanding that here, but that takes 3 years. And then phosphate, we used to get the bulk of internationally traded phosphate from the Chinese, but the Chinese are having food security issues, and so they've banned all export. So we're looking at a breakdown in the supply system for all three fertilizers at the same time, and we should not expect it to get better in the next 2 years. So we're already seeing in more advanced countries a degree of crop switching, less corn, less soy, more hay, for crops that are less fertilizer intensive. And in poorer countries, whether it's South Asia or Sub-Saharan Africa, we're seeing countries just not use much fertilizer. Now, we don't know how bad this is going to be until we get some harvest forecasts. We'll probably get that around September. But we're looking at the worst global harvest year in years. And that is going to generate the start of a multi-year famine. There is no way to avoid it at this point. The war could end tomorrow, and it's already too late for this season.
So I want to really sum up what I'm hearing and then tie it into something you said on Breaking Points, basically like this era defining reality, which is globalization moving forward, has been just the defining post-Cold War political reality in this country. And this goes to why you said, quote, all of the successful or presidential candidates post 1991. So Bill Clinton combined with Ross Perot, George W. Bush, President Obama, Trump, Biden, you have an interesting case to make there, are basically running the more populist campaign that in many ways is kind of responding to excesses of globalization, at least like rhetorically.
That's definitely a big piece of it. Yes.
So if that era has come to a close, though, how do you think this underlying dynamic of globalization being over and folks saying, wait a second, I do miss Amazon delivering everything to me in a day? Oh, I'm no longer concerned about my job going in the 70s because jobs are coming back now, yet I have to suffer because this isn't great to get my new car. How do you think that will shift this dynamic?
Oh, Americans are going to bitch a lot. That's unavoidable. Luckily, a lot of the new manufacturing technology...
Wait, quick thing. Does Americans bitching a lot, does that help the pro-globalization side rhetorically?
I don't think so. Who does that help? Our political system is in one of its periods of generational reset, when the factions move around, and every party for most of their duration has like one faction who's kind of first among equals, if you will. In the Republican Party, that was the business community for a long time, but Trump ejected the business community from the Republican coalition. So we're not having that kind of coherent discussion of economic matters that we normally would expect to see within the Republican coalition. The business community might come back, they might switch to the Democrats, they might become swing voters, don't know. We're not to the point where we can have that discussion nationally and coherently yet. Luckily, there are a lot of new technologies in manufacturing that support a supply chain system that is much closer to the consumer, sometimes even co-located. So when you take things like the ultra cheap stuff coming out of the shale fields that can be used to make more value added products like plastics, that's a completely domestic supply chain. You marry that to something like, say, 3D printing, and anyone who has a warehouse can now also be a manufacturing center. So it's not so much that you have an Amazon distribution center close by and get products the next day. It's that you have someone's, like Amazon's, distribution and manufacturing center nearby, and your product is made and delivered to you the next day. That is going to be the norm for probably about 1/3 of consumer goods. And then the more advanced stuff like your washing machines and your cars, you know, we already have a lot of that here. And the Mexicans are proving remarkably creative at moving up the value added scale very quickly. I'd say in terms of total labor productivity, the Mexicans have now passed the Canadians.
Wow.
There are plenty of pinch points. There's no way we adapt to this quickly, but we were seeing the fastest industrialization process in the American history in the last year of the Obama administration. And then with COVID, it sped up. And now with Biden, it's speeding up more. We're moving in the right direction. We'll get there.
So, but what does that have to, so fair, totally agree with your point about the coalitions and not being quite clear. How do you think that dynamic though of populists every 4 to 8 years will shift given, once again, the end of globalization? If so much of that populism was about responding to decisions made from, let's say, 1991 to basically 2002, how could you see that shifting? Because I don't quite know what the populist reaction to what you're describing is. If you kind of know what I mean.
I hear you. And I don't think they know yet. And what, yeah, I don't think they know yet either. And that's part of the beauty of populism is it attracts support without even having a policy. It's just catches the ennui and the anger. As a rule, when we're going through these political reshufflings, that's when the populists are the loudest. And as a rule, when we're done with the reshuffling, the populists are shoved back into the closet. What's going on right now is every faction wants to be the issue that is the litmus test for loyalty to the party. And so whether it's an issue on race or abortion or inequality, everyone is screaming. It usually takes 8 to 12 years for us to sort this out. We are now in year 7. So we have at least one more presidential cycle to go through, unfortunately. I can't do more than hazard a random guess as to what the factions will look like on the backside. But the idea that in a rapidly aging demographic, because we're aging too, that the rules of the past apply might be a bit of a reach.
What's a rule? Yeah, what's a past rule that you think is going on the way out?
Well, it's when populations get older, they get a little bit more crotchety. And so yeah, I can love the see euphemisms. Us at least, I can see at least for a few years, us getting a third party where the populists of the left and the populists of the right are more or less on the same page. And that won't be stable having three parties. It will always collapse back to two. But for the first time in American history, one of those parties might actually be populist. We won't know for a few more years. But when I see people like Donald Trump and Joe Biden basically having exactly the same foreign policy and economic policy, I can see that working.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. I mean, I guess the other macro trend I actually wanted to get with you, which you've talked a bit about in the past in the podcast, is urbanization and general demographic movement, both in country and among countries. So obviously a hallmark of globalization has been mass immigration. And obviously populism pushes against that maybe here in the West, but that's not, you know, look, even then we still have massive numbers of immigrants relative to our past. How do you think it's going to change both movement of people since we already seeing changes in movements of capital?
I think that's going to slow down, unfortunately. A lot of the countries that we've historically gotten population from in the last half century have been Mexico and Central America, and they're tapping out. They started the industrialization process later, but now it's been going for at least 25 years. So their population structure is starting to become a little shy of kids. So I think we're going to see, I mean, Mexican migration to the United States for the last 13 years has been negative for 12 of the 13. Central Americans are going to grow into that club here in the next few years. Any other population movements you're talking about, that's us going out and getting people. That won't happen without a change in mindset. Now, I am part of that business community that is now politically disenfranchised. I would be thrilled if the administration, regardless of whether it's Biden, Trump, or someone else, would play that game. Because if you look at what's going on right now in the world, you know, in Ukraine, you've got 45 million people that are going to have their country destroyed, and they have first world educations. There's a wonderful opportunity there. In Russia, a country that we said is a real shit show, there are a small number of people, less than 3 million, who are actually skilled technologically that are trying to get out. And what a wonderful opportunity there too. So every time a country in the wider world gets smacked up the head, there's an opportunity to go there and to basically poach. But we need a change in mindset on our side before we can do that. I don't think that's going to happen in this administration. We'll see what the next one looks like.
Yeah.
Here's the kind of big meta question that I think really undergirds like your past few books, which is era is coming to a close. This is like the post 1946 thing. All the settlements and decisions we made are basically running on fumes or are exhausted. I'm curious why you don't think though that this void we're seeing is going to be filled. So for example, you're talking about how there's going to be this massive gap when it comes to, let's say, this public good, which is like the global commons of sea trade and all those bits. Like, why won't we just see an environment where, you know, the US, Japan, Vietnam, the EU, a reconstituted NATO, don't basically just say, you know what, like, let's have a more regional security structure when it comes to ships and divisions. Okay, the US has like the furthest reach. US, you concentrate within, you know, the Asia to Indo-Pacific. The Europeans, like, we're clearly like more, we have a incentive to not have our economy collapse. So we're going to focus more on the Mediterranean or the Balkan states. Like, why won't we just basically see this void be filled as we've seen during previous transitions?
It will be filled, but that takes time. Most countries don't have the economic self-sufficiency or the military reach to do it right now. It takes time to build that. And first, we have to get through the dark side of this. So first, we have deglobalization. First, we have the American withdrawal. First, we have the Chinese collapse. And as all that is going on, new powers will rise, but not tomorrow. Probably not this decade. The ones that are most likely are Turkey, Japan, France, and Argentina. They've kind of got the magic mix of demographic flexibility or strategic reach or an ability to interface with raw materials suppliers and markets, or maybe just have a good partnership with the United States. But that doesn't happen overnight.
How Japan, given the demographic?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Japan has been aging slowly for a long time. And don't get me wrong, they are still the world's oldest country. But the pace of their aging has been surpassed by dozens of other countries now. And they have managed to not just automate a lot of their industry successfully. They did it in an environment before there was a capital crunch, so it's already in place. Mm-hmm. And they've offshored a lot of their manufacturing to countries with better demographics. So they've already found a way to kind of work with this. And they've also cut a deal with the United States under the Trump administration. So, you know, if you can deal with Trump and Biden, I think that says volumes about their strategic flexibility. So they've kind of bought their way into the club, so to speak, which is like the worst possible thing for the Chinese.
Man, and this is why focusing on 1946 is helpful. A, to your point, I kind of, there's a condensed version of this history, which isn't useful analytically, which is in 1946, we committed to building the post-war. No, like there was 10 years of decolonization, the Korean War, that whole like, you know, Greek and, you know, Turkish thing. So yeah, like there was a lot of chaos in that story. But I think the other question would be, and this is a little separate from the whole realignment of the political parties question that I'll basically close with after one last one after this, which is basically, this era is not coinciding with a functional political system in the United States.
Oh, absolutely.
So a key detail of 1945 is you have, once again, people's beef with New Deal liberalism aside, like that was a definition of a governing structure which could respond to that era. So can you talk about the American political system's like structural inability, regardless of where it goes policy-wise, to seem to come up with an answer to this? Because I think people who think Trump coming back in 2024 is going to address any of these issues, you're out to lunch. So yeah.
Well, you've hit a good point, because from 1945 to 1955, every imperial power had been smashed. The Soviet Union had built its Iron Curtain. And for 10 years, we had the United States at the height of its relative power versus the world. Most of the world was devastated. And it still took 10 years to build out the system we now know. We're doing anything that might come out of this now. The United States has gone home. Its military is inappropriate for the job. Its economy is renationalizing, and its politics are in a dither. There isn't anyone out there that has the capacity to displace or replace the United States on the global stage. The best you can hope for is some tight regional systems around powers that are relatively coherent themselves. But a global order, that does not make.
So, Peter, I guess my last question for you is this chaotic time it's difficult to live through. Something Marshall and I always try to reference is that when you're living through a period of stagnation, it's hard to understand. As in, the people in the 1890s weren't like, we're living in a stagnating period. They were just like, oh, this area. It was only in retrospect, you're like, wow, nothing was happening. So for a lot of people who are listening to this, I think the reason we even have an audience, a lot of people, is because we're giving voice to the forces that are leading to these feelings of malaise that a lot of people have, and they want to know how to get out of it. So is there anything that people can do on an individual level to have hope? Where should they look to? And then you personally, having written these books and understanding these forces, how do you deal with it?
Well, I'd say not only do people not realize they're in an era of stagnation until it's over, people don't realize they're in a golden age until it's over.
Great point.
And from 1985 until 2015, that was the fastest period of economic growth ever for everyone. We're not going to have something like that again. That was the highlights of globalization. And it was great, but it was a moment in time. Structurally, it was a moment in time demographically. And now it's over. All I can tell you is, if you're American, the next 5 years are going to be a wild ride. Yes, it's going to be inflationary. Yes, it's going to be probably also going to be record growth rates. It's an exciting time to be alive. I'm not saying that there's not going to be parts of the world that aren't going to be interesting from an economic point of view, but the old rules are gone and we are literally making up the new ones as we go. So if you are aggressive, the world is your oyster right now, but just, you know, pay attention to your security.
Man, I'll close with this. You just summed up the political communications problem for the Biden administration, because that clip went viral on Twitter where I think it was a press secretary was saying, but look at the job growth numbers. Right. Look at all these like different like economic statistics. This goes to your point about fastest growth ever. But everyone's like, yeah, but look at $5, $6 gas. These two things are happening. In the 70s, when you have like high inflation, the economy was also kind of in the crapper. So seeing these both at the same time does not produce a coherent political message. We don't have a framework.
We're used to oil going up when the dollar goes down and vice versa, and now they're doing this, and that is devastating for a lot of people, but not here.
Well, great. That's what I got, Peter. Really appreciate you joining us again, just talking to us. I really got a lot out of the conversation. It always makes me think, and your books, and not just that, I mean, I've told you this before on Breaking Point, you have a tremendous online following, man. I don't know. It truly, one of the most searched for guests in the history of Breaking Points. Marshall, I don't know if you've taken a look at this channel's research data, but it wouldn't surprise me there as well. So congratulations for everything that you do. And I really appreciate you joining us.
My pleasure. You guys take care.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.